Hey everybody, this is Hayes Carl, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Welcome to Amplified Houston on 90.1 FM, KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston, Texas, 89.5 FM in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, kpft.org. I'm your host, Ayla Degenpour with Houston Food Bank.
And I'm Bianca Ramos with Boys and Girls Club of Greater Houston. Joining us today, we have Dr. Ann Friedman, Director of Workplace Wellness at Mental Health America of Greater Houston, as well as Titus Benton, Chief of Staff at United Against Human Trafficking.
First up this morning, we're speaking with Dr. Ann Friedman, Director of Workplace Wellness at Mental Health America of Greater Houston, and we're going to talk about trauma-informed workplaces, mindfulness, and strengthening mental health systems. Good morning, Dr. Friedman.
Good morning. Glad to be here today.
Yes, I am excited to jump into this conversation. I think that our listeners and all of us will get a lot out of it. And so why don't we start at the very beginning? So, Dr. Friedman, what drew you to focus your work on workplace wellness within the broader field of psychology?
So I've worked since I was 20 years old. I had to work through graduate school, even undergraduate. And, you know, workplaces are stressful, and we don't leave our personal stress at home. We bring it to the office. So many people can't afford therapy. What I do is not therapy, but it's highly therapeutic and helpful in work environments. So I'm bringing it to the people.
Amazing. And so, you know, you kind of touched on this a little bit already, but I think when people think about mental health, they most often think about therapy, right? And so how do mindfulness and compassion-based practices fit into prevention and long-term resilience?
Yeah. So when we're doing mindfulness and compassion-based practices, we're not going back into our histories, talking about our childhoods. We're doing practices that we know science-based that can help us right now. So science tells us that mindfulness will help us decrease anxiety, improve attention and focus, boost immune system functioning, strengthen memory, reduce stress in general. And it's so scientifically based that the U.S. military is using it. So these are concrete practices that you can do, you know, to improve your mental and physical health.
That's pretty amazing. And so, you know, I think something that we've all experienced is, and you know, understand and see, is that chronic stress is common in today's culture. And so how does that unaddressed stress or trauma show up in workplace dynamics? Like you mentioned earlier, people don't always just leave it at home, right, when they come into the office.
I wish we could. Wouldn't that be nice? Leave it at home. Nope. So we know through many, many research surveys that burnout affects 3 in 5. Over half of American workers are experiencing burnout. And what happens with burnout? First of all, exhaustion. We are just wiped out physically, and absenteeism because of that. And then the cynical negativity that we begin to experience affects our relationships at the office. So affects our interactions with coworkers. And we know that about a quarter of all people, our workers, are saying, I'm not motivated to even do my best work here. So it is affecting productivity, it's affecting interactions at work, and it needs to be addressed by companies.
Yeah. And so, you know, another thing that you teach is collaborative communication. And so, why is communication such a critical piece of psychological safety?
Well, most of us are conflict avoidant, right? None of us want to get into conflict. And unfortunately, what we do is suppress, suppress, suppress until something explodes. That's kind of common here. And when we are upset, we are functioning from the back part of our brain, the very reactive part that is very survival based, and so is the other person. And those conversations are not helpful. They're full of blame and shame and comparing and, just judgment. Not at all helpful in resolving anything. So what I'm teaching with collaborative communication is how to look beneath what is being said, perhaps being said very unskillfully. But there is a need there that is not being expressed. And if I can help people hear each other's needs, and all needs are universal and human, then we don't have to demonize each other. We don't have to, oh, that guy's just an ogre. He's just awful, horrific. No, he's a human being that is struggling to get his needs met and maybe not doing it skillfully, just like me.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that. And you know, I want to go back to mindfulness for a second as well, sort of, and how that works with collaborative communication. And because I think mindfulness has become a very mainstream word. I think we've all heard it, but it's often misunderstood. And so, how do you define the mindfulness side of things at a clinical and practical sense?
Yeah. So as a psychologist, I will tell you that mindfulness is now being included in all kinds of therapy. And why is that? Because we function so much out of that reactive back part of our brain that is all about survival and constructing reality. And is not often helpful. We are trying to move to the front part of our brain where we have more higher level thinking and impulse control and judgment. And so mindfulness teaches ways to calm and observe experience. We don't know how many thoughts a human being has a day. They're saying in the neuroimaging labs it could be somewhere between 12,000 and 80,000. Some of which you choose, but the majority of which you do not. They just pop into your brain. Nobody in your right mind would think, oh, I want to be mad right now. Give me an angry thought. I want to be mad, right? Nobody would do that. So, what we're learning to do with mindfulness is to pay attention to the present moment without judgment. So, the thoughts of the moment without reactiveness, just noticing thoughts and not necessarily reacting to them. And there are dozens of practices that can help us learn this. It's something you have to do, like exercise. You can hear about it, read about it, but if you don't do it, it doesn't work. You have to practice it. But I will tell you that it can be a game changer. So, for me in 2006, when I started practicing this and learned about it, I was a psychologist who had had two panic attacks that year. And it changed my life. I never had one again. And it was learning how to calm my body and observe my thoughts without reactivity.
Wow, yeah, that's an incredibly powerful tool, or it can be, right? If we work those muscles and exercise them. And I can see how it would be particularly useful and helpful in workplace situations, especially with the stress of our lives and the stress of work and the stress of, you know, communicating with our coworkers. And you know, so you mentioned that organizations have started to notice this, right, and adopt these practices. But what are some of the most common misconceptions that organizations have about especially trauma-informed approaches?
Yeah, so many corporations are using mindfulness now. All of the big ones are. Aetna Insurance, in fact, did studies for 2 years with their employees and found it lowered absenteeism. They had less costs with insurance on sick visits. So companies are definitely using this. But with regard to trauma specifically, which is something I also teach about, is, people are afraid to bring it up. And in fact, that's not helpful. We think if we don't talk about it, it won't be there. No, many, many people are trauma survivors from childhood or even present day. It's coming from all sorts of experiences in our lives. And so to make a safe work environment where things can be discussed and basic training on trauma can make a difference. We do a lot of this at Mental Health America. That it's when we're talking about it, it's not an excuse for poor behavior at work. Oh, that person's a trauma survivor. We've just got to let them act it out and whatever. No, that's not what we're doing. We're providing them support, but we're also going to hold them to a standard just like everyone else, right? And we can do that. We can do that. And that all employees need to be involved with this, not just human resources.
And so, we've talked a lot about the workplace and adults and all of us grown-ups, but you work with both adults and youth. So are there differences in how these tools are received across those age groups?
I would say the bulk of my clients have been adults, and adults have a lot more life experience to be able to bring this in. But I will tell you that I have worked for years with children as young as 6 years old. And one of the stories that I love best was a parent bringing the child to me saying, "My child is acting out, having fits at school, and getting in trouble constantly." And I taught her about breathing, how she can use her breath to calm herself. And the mother later reported to me that she had stopped throwing fits at school. So it can be beneficial for all age groups.
That's incredible. And so, that's, I think, a great example of how mindfulness really can play a role in helping, to soothe that stress in those situations. Can you maybe share an example of how communication or mindfulness training changed a workplace culture team dynamic?
Yes, I am so proud of this. So I worked for 8 months in one of the major hospitals with one of the divisions that had rated the lowest in employee engagement. They were totally burned out, cynical, tired. It was a bad situation. And they brought me in to work with the team. And we did a number of different things. But at the end of the year, they had moved from the bottom of employee engagement to the top of the hospital.
That's incredible. That's
It's
a
my
big
favorite
jump.
story. And
That's a
it
huge
was their
jump.
evaluation, not mine.
That's amazing. And so, as we wrap up this segment, for listeners who want to strengthen mental health in their own workplace or family, what's one first step that they can take?
Yeah, first of all, to talk to each other, be honest and open with each other about what's going on. Mental Health America can be a resource. We have classes here. We do free meditations every morning, Monday through Friday, if you go on our website. We also have a Care Connect, which is a resource if you do need therapy. It will help you locate someone in your area that specializes in what you do, and even a pro bono or sliding fee scale, some of the therapists do, so you can get help. So, inviting you to come on our website for Mental Health America of Greater Houston, and you'll find many, many resources. But the primary thing is talk to each other.
Amazing. That is a great first step, I think, that all of us can take. And so thank you, Dr. Friedman, for being with us and discussing this morning. And for those who are tuning in, as a reminder, you are listening to Amplified Houston Thursday edition. Amplified Houston is a collaboration of five nonprofit organizations: Baker Ripley, Boys and Girls Club of Greater Houston, Children at Risk, The Women's Home, Houston Food Bank, and Houston's community radio station, KPFT Pacifica Radio.
Closing out today's episode with us is Titus Benton, Chief of Staff at United Against Human Trafficking. And today we're going to be talking about how community systems respond to human trafficking, support survivors, prevention, and systemic change. So welcome to Amplified Houston, Titus.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Super excited to have you here. So I wanted to start off about learning more about your role and what you do as Chief of Staff at United Against Human Trafficking and how your team contributes to the organization's mission here in Houston.
Sure. Well, as Chief of Staff, you know, my primary job is just to oversee the internal operations of the organization. Kind of everything rolls up to me in terms of problem solving. We all have jobs and organizations and things come up. And so that's my primary responsibility, together with the CEO and with our board of directors. You know, we work really hard on strategy, particularly that collaborative strategy you just mentioned, and how our team interacts with other agencies, other stakeholders in the community to combat this scourge of trafficking that's so prevalent that a lot of people talk about. But there's a lot of myths to bust and there's a lot of work to do. And so every day when I wake up, those are the things I get to tackle.
That's amazing. So I know United Against Human Trafficking focuses on a lot on both supporting survivors and preventing exploitation. Mm-hmm. So how does those two elements work together, and why is it important to balance immediate support along with long-term prevention?
Yeah, absolutely. And to give people maybe some handlebars to grasp this with, you know, we live in Houston and Houston floods all the time, and we all know how we react to floods, but then we also know how important preventing flooding is. And so if you think about it similarly, there's a reactivity that comes with survivor care and direct services, and that's needed. And we will always be doing that important work. But it's also really essential that we get upstream from the problem. And so we do a lot of work around demand for trafficking. We try to engage with other stakeholders in the community, whether that's law enforcement or other NGOs, to work together just to help people understand signs that trafficking is going on, vulnerabilities that exist in communities. There's lots of intersectional kind of topics that we work in with marginalized folks who are more susceptible to trafficking. Because if we don't get upstream from the problem, then we will find ourselves only being reactive. And that's just not a place we want to find ourselves.
Yeah, correct. So I kind of wanted to go back a little bit to, you hinted at myths about human trafficking. So many people think of trafficking as something that happens somewhere else rather than here in our communities. So what patterns or realities have you seen in Houston region that challenges this misconception?
Great question. I think, you know, to everyone's credit, there's a growing awareness and concern that trafficking is an issue. But I do think, as pop culture sort of educates us on the issue, there are some myths that are perpetuated that are simply false. For example, most people, when they think about trafficking, they sort of think of the stranger in a white van situation. That happens, but it accounts for single-digit percent of trafficking cases. Most people are trafficked by people they know, often by family members. Most people think that trafficking only occurs in like these dark corners of our community. I live in Katy. I can name a trafficking case that occurred at a very large house in a very nice neighborhood. And I'm sitting about a mile from a strip mall in Cinco Ranch, where there was a trafficking bust just a few years ago. So it's happening in suburbs. It's happening across demographic groups. It's happening next door, not just happening somewhere else.
So yeah, thank you for, you know, bringing awareness that sometimes it is the people that are closest to you that you know, create that damage. So United Against Human Trafficking works with both adults and minor survivors, correct? So what differences or unique needs do you see between these age groups, and how does that shape the services or systems you kind of deploy?
Yeah, for sure. So with minors, often our primary work with minors is on the prevention side. And so we go into juvenile detention centers. We work with other at-risk, unhoused drop-in centers for youth. We get a lot of disclosures, and what we normally do with those disclosures of trafficking is we refer those to agencies that work primarily with minors, because you're right, there is a different set of needs there, and there's all sorts of legal implications too when those crimes are committed against minors that are somewhat different with adult populations. And so there is a need for some specialization there. For us with the adult survivors, you know, we often are encountering people who have kids that need a job to provide for their kids. So it's not just their own survival that they're thinking about, but they're thinking about their own children that they need to provide for. And so all sorts of needs come up. And that is that becomes very intense case management that takes up a lot of time with the adult population.
And you kind of talked a little bit about how you work with, you know, communities, law enforcement, healthcare, and social services. And, you know, they often react immediately to situations like this. So what structural challenges arise in coordinating these systems to respond more effectively to trafficking? And how does your organization help bridge those divides?
Yeah, so we were delighted last year to celebrate our 20th year in Houston, and we were started as a coalition. So the Houston Rescue and Restore Coalition was started 21 years ago, and it was to address the very thing you just mentioned. You know, anytime you have concerned people in a city this big, communication can be hard. Mm-hmm. The old joke that Houston's an hour away from Houston is true, like coordinating services. And all that is very difficult. We also know that we have very strong commitment to this issue with our law enforcement partners. But law enforcement doesn't think the way social services agencies think, and social services agencies don't think the way law enforcement thinks. So that you have to sit down at the table and have honest conversations. I was at one yesterday in Fort Bend County as we work on a new initiative in that county. And so communication is key. Trusting each other is key. Trying to map out services in a way that makes sense is something that we really strive at. So we have regular coalition meetings. We have lots of communication in between those meetings. We've been doing a lot of work together around the World Cup, which is coming this summer. And so as a coalition leader, that is our primary work and our core competency and what we spend a lot of time doing.
And Titus, trafficking is both a social and economic problem.
Mm-hmm. So
what ways do economic pressures, isolation, or lack of community safety nets make certain populations more vulnerable for exploitation?
Yeah, I mean, you answered it in the question. It's just a reality that people that find themselves at a disadvantage economically, that find themselves in a desperate situation, are more susceptible to being exploited. And so we see it all the time. We've seen people exploited because they don't have a place to live. Mm-hmm. We've seen people exploited, particularly with labor trafficking, when they're desperate financially.
Yeah.
We've seen people who maybe have an economic disadvantage who are exploited in all sorts of ways. And so trying to deal with that, and then even coming out of an experience of exploitation, you know, you're still at a disadvantage because you may have been trafficked, but you had a roof over your head, or you were given a meal a day, and now you're out of the life, but now you have all these needs you have to fulfill on your own. And that's a real challenge for folks. Housing is an enormous challenge. So there's all sorts of issues that arise, and they're very complicated and nuanced problems with complicated and nuanced solutions.
And as we're coming closer to the end of this segment, Titus, would you be able to share like an example or a success story that has really impacted you from the benefits that they had with this organization?
Yeah, I think about collaboration and our ability to work with our partners. We had a faith-based partner recently that had a survivor of trafficking that was needing to travel. And we have a great partnership with Southwest Airlines where we're given travel vouchers. And so by leading that coalition and that collaborative work, mm-hmm. we were able to work together to get their client those vouchers so that they could get where they needed to go and take care of their personal business. And so, and that was a partner with which we hadn't had a close relationship recently, but we were able to sit down and talk about the needs that they had and meet those needs. And that's happening every day with our partners. We're really proud of how we're working together and locking arms to serve survivors of trafficking.
Yeah, I love that, that, you know, you're having all these other communities, you know, support this amazing mission. So that's incredible to hear. And lastly, Titus, for listeners who want to get involved, whether it's supporting financially or volunteering, advocacy, or employee engagement to raise awareness, what are tangible ways that they can contribute to anti-trafficking efforts in their own communities?
Yeah, something everyone can do is jump on our website, unitedagainsthumantrafficking.org. That's your one-stop shop. You can link to our podcast, our volunteer form, all those sorts of things. We're looking for corporate partners. So if you work for a corporation that's looking for volunteer opportunities, we have those. We will partner with anybody who's passionate about this issue to continue our work.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for joining us today, Titus. It was a pleasure having you here on Amplified Houston.
Thanks so much.
This has been Amplified Houston, a collaborative production of Houston's leading nonprofit organizations. We want to thank our guests for their time and excellent work they do. So thank you to Dr. Ann Friedman, Director of Workplace Wellness at Mental Health America of Greater Houston, Titus Benton, Chief of Staff over at United Against Human Trafficking. We will see you on the radio, Amplified Houston. Tune in Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM or stream online at kpft.org. Be sure to stay tuned for Irish Airs, a longtime running music program hosted by Pete Little. It's now or never. Come hold me tight. Kiss me, my darling.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. I can't be scared away. Or negotiated with. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire, and as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
KPFT artist profile, Mary Gaucher.
KPFT is very, very important because it builds community around songwriters. It's about independent people and independent artists who are singing truths and who are being brave. It's about having voices where there's not often a microphone to speak into. There is an independence to all of this that's inspirational and I think deeply American. There's a really important value to being introduced to artists that you wouldn't find anywhere else, to give a voice to those who have something to say that hasn't been distilled through the machinery of a corporate entity. This is of great value to all of us in a community that is gathered around mutual respect. Great conversations are a part of great art. So the station has always been a conduit for that and will continue to be with your help.
Listen for her music and other local artists right here on KPFT.
Hi, this is Buddy Monlock. I'm always happy to be back in Houston and here in KPFT studio. It's great to be here. I don't know how many times I've been on live here. It's really fun to come in and talk with the DJs and play some songs live. So I really enjoy that. So yeah, please keep listening to KPFT. It's important and they're the ones who are playing the kind of music that you love and that I love and that me and my friends make. They're kind of holding the torch for us all here. So keep listening to KPFT and maybe do your part when it comes time for the pledge drive.